Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Morning, everyone. It's 7:04 here, local time in the Minneapolis area. It's the 30th of August. The sun is rising and Jesus, the Son of God, is risen. And that is good news indeed, for there is always hope and always future in his beautiful kingdom. We talked about so many of the headlines of the day in the first hour with Bob Smetana and Ben Johnson. And I just so appreciate them coming on the program and talking about these things, not from a Republican or Democratic perspective, but really from a kingdom perspective, because it is the only kingdom that has no end. And this is Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, joined in studio by Logan Rausch and Paul Perreault, who, along with Rachel Sutton, bring these guests in that we do have that can talk about these things from a Christian perspective. And some of the news headlines, obviously we get into the serious stuff, but I'm very mindful that it is state fair season, especially all around the Midwest. We've been seeing the fairs in Wisconsin, the Dakotas, Iowa, and about 3 miles down the road from our studio here in St. Paul, Minnesota, the Minnesota get-together is going on, and hundreds of thousands of people coming each week to the state fair. And our very own Logan Rausch here in studio, a producer, runs the sound, is going to be joining Carmen LaBurge, our midday show host on Faith Radio, to talk about being a state fair superfan. And of course, now I have Jim Bilby, professor of Christian theology, in the studio. And during the break, we had a little point counterpoint about whether somebody should go to the state fair, be a superfan. Logan is that. But Jim, I understand you would be the exact antithesis of a state fair superfan. So give us the counterpoint on this, Jim.
Well, you actually said there are hundreds of thousands of people. By my count, there's billions of people. And you have to park about 10 miles north of here to walk 13 miles to get there.
Yeah.
And the food, you just look at it, you try triglycerides go to about 400,000. So I don't need any of that. So let me see. Crowds, parking long ways away, rides I don't want to go on, food even if I kind of want to eat, I shouldn't eat it. I seriously might pay a couple hundred dollars to not go, but then they charge you to get in. So to me, it's such a slam dunk. I realize I'm getting old and curmudgeonly about
sure,
this.
Sure, right.
But that's where I'm at. Logan, come on. Come back at me.
You got a counterpoint here on Logan?
First of all, great thing about it, crowds. I love people. It's always good to meet strangers, say hello to people.
Are you actually meeting these people,
You
Logan?
Absolutely are. If I've got to wait 25 minutes for a bucket of cookies, I'm going to make some friends along the way.
Okay, I love it. Well, I'm sure more. This is the important conversations of our faith, is it not? I mean, I can't imagine anything better. Jim, I love having you in studio talking about just really any of the questions that we have. I know we've talked at length off the air about how often students in our classroom are coming with the same kind of questions of our faith week in and week out. And we try to address them in the segment on Thursdays at 7 o'clock Minnesota time around Just Ask Anything. And we would love for you. You've been texting in as listeners and calling in as listeners. You can call the studio at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. And I promise you all questions are fair game, and we'll absolutely do the best we can to answer what you bring to the table. I know the first question of the day is going to revolve around some really difficult headlines that came out this week, where a 9-year-old boy took his own life after coming out of the closet and revealing to his mother that he was gay, had the support of his mother, but his school friends began to bully him, and he took his own life. How do we process such difficult questions that are really impacting us day in and day out in our churches and our families and our lives? So that's up next here on Faith Radio Mornings. It is 9 minutes past the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings, and as mentioned, joined on Thursdays at this time by Jim Bilby, a professor of Christian theology, who just helps us navigate such difficult questions of faith week in and week out. We've talked about suffering. We've talked about things like astrotheology and alien life, and this morning we're going to get down into the real life, I think, where so many of us are living. I've been teaching human sexuality for the better part of 10 years, and I would say over the last 5 or 6 years, the conversation around same-gender relationships has exploded in my classroom, and it is so tricky and difficult to navigate. And, of course, the headline I referenced, Jim, that was so tough this week was not only are we experiencing so many questions around our gender and our identity and same-sex attraction, but then you combine it with the rise of depression, the rise of bullying on social media, and so you have this incredible, difficult storm all coming together in a situation of a 9-year-old boy who took his own life this past week after coming out to his mother that he was gay and then experiencing the bullying that it was exacerbated in school and then took his life. You know, if you're listening this morning, you have comments or questions or thoughts on this or any of the questions, again, please call or text at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. But Jim, just sort of first impression of the story. Where do we even begin to process this situation?
Yeah, Peter, this is a great example of sometimes these questions that become paralyzing. Because, one, they're just so controversial, and we feel like if we say anything, we're going to say something wrong, right? But even more than that, this is paralyzing because there's so many different layers of this. So let me just try to kind of peel back some of the layers of this onion. There's, of course, the biblical question. Well, what should we Christians think about homosexuality? And that actually, I'm not saying it's an easy question, but I think it's relatively easy compared to some of the other psychological, sociological, cultural questions,
yep.
right?
Yep.
So there's that layer of the question. But even, and I think much more difficult, is the cultural phenomenon that we're experiencing that is pushing kids at this incredibly young age to, this is who I am and this is who I identify. And certainly what we know is that there are children that have, if the term is gender dysphoria, that they have sort of questions about their identity and whether they're guy enough or whether they're female enough at young ages. And what we also know is that many times at those early onset gender dysphoria resolves itself if sort of left alone. But the problem is we're not leaving it alone. So both by peers that are bullying, both by, you know, parents that have incredible amount of anxiety. Oh, no, my goodness, my kid isn't what I thought they would be. And then try to push them into some sort of a mold, by the various ideologues in the conversation that want to grab onto this and use this kid as a tool to see my view on this particular issue is justified, because there's just so much of that that happens. And then let's not lose sight of the fact that we're dealing with, which you guys talked about in the last segment, a tidal wave of mental illness, and the implications of this are absolutely profound. And in the final analysis, a 9-year-old is loved by God, child of God, is not alive right now because of that.
Yeah, it's so well said, and you talk about the complexity and layers of it. And I mean, to think about being 9 years old and having to create a central identity of yourself based on some kind of attraction you may or may not be having. I mean, these are tricky conversations. You mentioned that we change and things develop, so to just fix ourselves in place and time based on some sort of experience. And of course, in the classrooms today, especially with the state mandates and government mandates around same-sex marriage in our country, that as early as 5, 6, and 7-year-old in the classroom, they're introducing young people to the idea that they might be gay, they might be straight, they might be transgender. I mean, we're so malleable, we're so moldable. And so the power of this suggestion, you know, this is really early to be having any of these conversations.
Yeah, it's really early. And then to add it even, you know, kind of additional layer to that makes this even worse. Our gender expectations are sometimes really unreasonable. So, I mean, think of it. Young girls look at, you know, magazines to, this is what it looks like to be a woman. And they look at themselves and, oh, I'm not this. And they, of course, they're not. They're not even developmentally to that place. And so they start wondering, oh, what's wrong with me? Guys, well, you know, to be a guy is to be big and strong, and you got to be a football player. And just biologically, there are some guys that are the alpha male, you know, types, and, you know, little kids, there's a little kid version of that, that they're stronger and bigger than the other kids. But there's the little kid in the class, the little boy that is like, I'm not the biggest, I'm not the strongest. Am I okay? Then am I really actually a male? Am I really? So we are creating additional gender dysphoria by our sort of narrow gender expectations that society places on these kids. And then we're making it worse by almost encouraging them to, and go think about this, because really you might be transgender, you might be this, or you might be this. And these kids are not emotionally capable of engaging these questions.
Yeah, it's such a great point. And as parents, I mean, I think about this mother, and as the story goes, is that her son was in the back seat when sort of cautiously and then said to his mom that, "Mom, I think I'm gay." And she responded by saying, I love you, son. And I'd be curious your thoughts, Jim, as this is going to be, I'm sure so many of the families that are listening today are experiencing these kinds of conversations within their own family or friendships. What do you suggest as sort of a first blush reaction? If somebody that you're close to comes out and says, you know, I really believe that I'm gay, or I really believe that I might be transgender, what, you know, how do we approach this in the moment that is most helpful for the long-term future?
It's a question, actually, that my wife is a therapist, and really probably she'd be better at it than I. But I think trying to channel what she says, I think I probably – the first thing is you have to manage your own anxiety, right? So if my child comes to me and has this scary sort of, I think I might be gay, or I might be this or that or the other thing, suddenly all my expectations for what I wanted them to be are like crumbling before my eyes. And so often my response, or the response of parents, becomes about me, becomes about managing my fears and managing my expectations. And the most important thing I think we can do is to be there for the kid at this moment. And it sounds like now we're getting a, you know, secondhand report, of course, or, you know, we weren't there at the time, but it sounds like this mom did very well.
Right.
And that is, listen, I love you. Right. I mean, there is nothing my kids could come and tell me that would cause me to not love them. And they need to know that. And I need to tell them that, and that, you know, whatever they're dealing with, I'm going to be walking through that with them, shoulder to shoulder, you know, carrying them through if I need to be. And that is the most fundamental thing, that they have a support structure at home as they're dealing with these things. Because oftentimes outside world and school, and certainly social media, just the disaster that is these days, those are not supportive places. So they need to know there's this safe place.
It's Jim Bilby, professor of Christian theology. And if you want to join the conversation, have some thoughts on what we're talking about this morning, which is how to navigate the difficult conversations going around same gender and transgenderism in our culture, you can join us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. Jim, when we come back from break, I'm going to ask you, so that initial move that I think is so rightly ordered, that we start by saying absolutely love is without question. What does the journey look like then from there in the months and the years ahead, and when these scenarios come up? So more to come with Jim Bilby here on Faith Radio Mornings. It's 20 minutes past the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Capstern, joined in studio by Dr. Jim Bilby, a professor of Christian theology, who joins me on Thursdays just talking about so many of the difficult conversations we often don't talk about in our faith. And of course, this morning we're talking a bit about same gender attraction, but specifically the story of the young boy who took his life after coming out of the closet, saying to his mother he was gay, and then receiving some of the bullying online. And Jim, again, the tentacles of the story, we could go anywhere near, need hundreds of hours on this, from social media to bullying to same gender to how we as parents come around our kids. There's just so much to get to. Sort of in our last bit of time that we have together this morning, you mentioned that as this first move that this mother did, and at least the reports indicate that she just said, "I love you, son," and that that's such an important first move in anybody close to us, friend or family member, to just be, this is without question. But what do the next 24 hours look like? What do the next 3 months look like? What are the next year? I mean, how do we, if we don't agree with this decision and it's our own kids that we're trying to mold and shape and shepherd, how do we as parents continue to come around them if there's a disagreement about this idea of same gender relationship? That's got to be one of the trickiest things of this process.
Yeah, clearly. So I don't know if there's any nice, neat, here's the blueprint and here's how it works, but a couple of general principles seem reasonable here, right? The idea of finding a therapist that is qualified to think through these issues, and to even more than that, to draw out of that child, the person asking this question, to draw out their feelings and to help them talk about that, I think is really important, right? So again, we have segment we're talking about, this mental health crisis, and we have this stigma surrounding mental health. And so then we have a corollary stigma surrounding therapy. And so therapy is what crazy people do, right?
Right,
and
right.
And this person isn't crazy. So there's this all this fear, and I think just having a person who is an expert in drawing people's questions out, drawing people's emotions out, helping them connect their emotions and feelings, that is absolutely a crucial step. And so that's if my child comes to me and says, I feel like I'm dealing with these issues, I first tell them I love them. The second thing I do is I talk to my people, my yeah. network, and I'm like, who is a good person for my child to be talking to right now? Who should I connect them with? And I create resources, because parents aren't, we can love our kids and we're the front line for that, but there's so much going on that we can't deal with it all ourselves. So we have to find our people. We have to find our resources and draw them together. And so that would start with a person who is a therapist, right? I would also try to find people in my child's life who had wrestled with these sorts of things before, right? And that they can, you know, see an example of this isn't a disaster that you can come through on the other side.
Yeah, and that, I mean, if your child is willing and receptive to just continue to have conversations, to just sort of gently suggest their identity is not in our sexuality, our identity is in being a son or a daughter of the King, and we may be having experiences of attractions, but those experiences don't necessarily speak to identity, if there's an openness. But if not, and if the child is saying, no, this is who I am. And we just had a question from somebody texting in the studio. What do we do when that might be the situation, and maybe even more so, where parents will say that they're going to intentionally raise their child as gay or lesbian, that they're going to embrace? How do we walk this out when there is an intentional embrace that says we are going to raise our children as gay or lesbian?
Well, the question, I suppose, is how should we Christians think about such events?
Sure.
I'm just going to say, part of me, I don't know.
Yeah.
Because here's the difficulty here. As a Christian, I look at that scenario and I say, well, that seems like a pretty bad choice. But here's the deal. There's a lot of bad choices being made in our culture. And I think one of the things that we Christians do that is not ideal is that we sort of take responsibility for all the bad things in the culture. And suddenly now I need to stamp that out.
Right.
And it's very difficult to stamp that out without the kids involved in the situation feel like you're trying to stamp them out, especially if they see this as their identity. So I want to I think the fundamental question is, how do we as Christians deal with our own things? And once we sort of get that figured out, then I think we're in a lot better position to suggest a better path. And maybe, hopefully, if we figure it out, if we do well with this, we don't even have to suggest. I mean, it'll be more obvious and more profound. But undoubtedly, it is a symptom in culture where if parents are sort of encouraging this and, oh yeah, this is who you are at this incredibly young age, it's a symptom of something deeply broken in our culture yeah. that we think that that's a good idea.
Yeah.
So anything we can do big picture to discourage that, to talk about gender identity or gender dysphoria as being, you know, it's natural for people to have questions, to ask questions about that. And when we sort of like encourage those questions and go, that means you're this, that's a really dangerous path to go down.
Yeah, we just have a couple minutes left in this, and I think it's so important. You mentioned just the idea that we want to just sort of try to stamp stuff out right away whenever it is maybe antithetical to what we believe. But is there a possibility, without it being just acquiescing to the situation, of taking the long view to say, you know what, we're going to have to just see how this plays out for a while, and we've got to work on our own stuff, because it might just shine a light in a different kind of way over time, and maybe there'll be an invitation in the future. But I don't know about you. I hardly ever find that it works to come and say, I'm against this, and it should stop right now. It just almost ends up kind of just dispersing the whole thing.
Well, and oftentimes what you do is you just cause people to dig in and sort of become intractable in their arguments. And again, that's one thing if you're talking about two adults, like I disagree. And that's okay, fine. That's disagreement, I think, is healthy. And we're a little scared of it in this culture. Let's disagree more. Let's disagree well, but let's disagree. What I worry about is when we, you know, dig in and we like, no, this is terrible. We're steamrolling people. We're becoming part of the machine that causes the 9-year-old to feel like they're wrong,
yeah,
that they're not okay, that their life isn't worth anything. And more than anything, we Christians have to avoid anything like that.
Jim, it's such helpful advice, and also recognizing the time is too short. We just knew we need about 127 hours on this subject at the very least, yeah. I find. So we'd love to have you back in, maybe even for a full hour next time, to talk specifically about so many of the dimensions of this. We're getting calls and texts that we just couldn't get to this morning, and we'd love to address that in the future. So thanks for joining us as you do here on Thursdays on Faith Radio.
My pleasure, Peter.
We'll take a break for Breakpoint and bottom of the hour news. And in the second half of our second hour, we're going to talk with Justin Holcomb about how we can recover from abuse in these situations like what's going on in the Catholic Church. So appreciate that kind of conversation with Dr. Jim Bilby. It's real. It is not using just a bunch of fake platitudes to try to get through the situation. These are real struggles that I think all of us are having as families and as friends, just trying to wrestle through the sea change of sexuality in our culture. We did get a call from Vince that we couldn't get to that said, what's a counselor going to say to a child with dysphoria? How it happens there? And I think part of the invitation Jim was suggesting is that to get with trusted counselors and recognize this is a journey, and children need trust and they need some places to walk this out. Because dysphoria, I think the numbers are over 90% of the time, resolves itself over time. But you really need places of trust to go. So thanks for the questions. Thanks for the text. When we come back here after a short break, we're going to be joined by Justin Holcomb. Continue to talk about these conversations, and specifically this time, how we can recover with trust when we've been abused or people around us have been abused, like what's going on in the Catholic Church today. So lots more to come on Faith Radio Mornings. Yesterday, we had great conversations just talking about the idea of how our allegiance really belongs to the kingdom. And Cal Thomas is on the program. He is the most widely read op-ed syndicated writer in our country, and he just did a beautiful job navigating that conversation.
Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world," and that's good enough for me. And I think one of the great temptations, especially of a lot of believers, and I wrote this in an earlier book, Blinded by Might, Why the Religious Right Can't Save America, is that we too often focus on this world and not on the kingdom of God, which is the only kingdom with power that will last forever. Paul tucks a little verse away in Romans 8 where he says, God has built futility into his creation in hope that the creation will turn to him. We've tried both parties. We've tried all philosophies. None of it is working. It's time to turn to God. Only he can work.
So beautifully said by Cal Thomas yesterday. If you want to catch that entire segment, you can head to myfaithradio.com and search Cal Thomas. It was a delight to have him on the program. So articulate, so passionate, and so much history and expertise. Love that he can just see that the kingdom is what remains in the end. Well, up next here in our last segment for Faith Radio Mornings, we'll be joined by Episcopalian priest Justin Holcomb, who will be talking about how we can recover from abuse when it happens in our lives or it touches those who are close to us. So stay with us for more on Faith Radio Mornings.
As parents, you and I want to give our kids everything, don't we? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. We want to lavish our children with good things, but I'm finding a generation of teens who expect over-the-top generosity. They have a sense of entitlement that blinds them to the fact that behind every gift is a gesture of sacrifice and generosity. In a world where teens feel like they deserve everything, the message of grace is lost. Mom, Dad, I challenge you to rethink your approach. We need to stop giving in and help our children understand healthy adult responses. When you do, you'll instill a deep sense of gratitude in your child.
Parenting gets a lot harder when you do it alone. Gather a group of parents and learn from Mark's wisdom together. You'll find a variety of small group curricula online at parentingtodaysteens.org.
Twenty minutes before the top of the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapster, and just happy to be joined on the line at this time by Justin Holcomb, regular contributor to the show. He's an Episcopal priest, and he's a professor of theology and Christian thought at Gordon-Conwell. And Justin, I appreciate you coming on to talk through some tricky issues that are happening in our headlines today.
My pleasure, and thank you for actually addressing it and shining some light on a dark subject.
Yeah, you know, and I think it's one of those things that I found in the courses that I've taught over the years, specifically the sexuality course, is that it really began to take my breath away as students wrote in, and they can kind of submit anonymously some of their past and some of their experience. And I found that if there's 30 students in a classroom, you know, at least 27, if not all 30, speak to profound brokenness, and very often that brokenness has to do with some kind of abuse in their family. And so how do we begin, Justin, just, you know, the headlines out of the Catholic Church coming, it's not unique to the Catholic Church. It happens in Catholic and Protestantism. How do we begin to bring this to the light more so than we do so that people can begin to experience healing when they've been abused?
First is to the church and others and Christians to acknowledge the travesty and the prevalence of this, to not be shocked or to say things like this has to be, you know, an attack against the faith, because no one's going against, you know, the Christian faith when they start saying that horrible things have happened. So acknowledging what's happening, believing people is a huge step, actually, because they feel silence and like they're not going to be believed. It takes so much courage to say what happened to them. So that's the first thing, just as the church and as Christians, that we can do. But the first thing for us to do is to also acknowledge, I was abused when I was 11. And so the first thing is to acknowledge and state clearly to yourself and to God what actually happened, and to realize that that's that the kind of suffering that you have gone through, that person has gone through, is something that God actually wants to engage. He wants to provide hope and healing for that person. So for me, acknowledgement is the starting point, and actually bringing it to God, whose disposition toward his children is one of grace and protection and provision, and knowing that he will and wants to, for his name's sake and for your healing, wants to engage and will heal. And there's some specific things we can talk about on what does it mean for, you know, the person and work of Jesus. If God became if Jesus is fully God and fully man, and he died on the cross and rose from the dead, what does that message mean for the darkness and pain that you've experienced because of sexual abuse?
I think that'd be incredibly important to get into this morning, Justin. It's one of the, again, the messages in the classroom. I'm actually teaching the first section of human sexuality here just after the show is over, and it's sort of the opening salvo of the class, that if the cross and the tomb can't handle all of the brokenness in our lives, then we're serving something that is less powerful than the brokenness itself. But how can people begin to start experiencing the redemptive healing of God in these situations when we know that the work of Jesus on the cross and that tomb can bring healing? But what does that look like? It's hardly ever a magic wand, right?
It's not, wonderfully said. It's not a magic wand, and it's going to be different depending on everyone's situation in the sense of how it applies. The heartbeat and the bedrock of our hope is that Jesus is God and man, that he died on the cross for our sins and because of the sins of the world, because of sin invading the world. He is conquering. He's not only accomplishing forgiveness for sins, he's actually conquering his enemy, Satan, and his effects of sin in the world. And so the one way, just there's numerous ways, but let's just pick one. One major effect of sexual abuse is shame. And the way that the Bible talks about shame, there's three images: nakedness, filthy, dirty, defiled, or outside of the camp, or isolated, or not part of the community. So naked, dirty, and alone. Well, the great news is that Jesus has entered into our experience of being human, but without sin. That's what Hebrews tells us. And when he was dying on the cross, when he was his passion week of betrayal, he experienced all of those. He was actually stripped naked on our behalf, took our nakedness, took the vulnerability. He was defiled both by the sins of the world that were placed upon his shoulders, but also literally he was mocked and defiled and filthy, and he was crucified outside of the camp. He did all of those things. He took nakedness so we could have his robe of righteousness. He took our filth of the sins we've done and the sins done to us so we could be washed clean. And he was crucified outside of the camp so we could be adopted into the family. So to shame, just that one effect, we have the work of Christ specifically saying, no, because of me and what I have done, you're clean, you're covered in the righteousness of Christ. You're no longer vulnerable and naked, and you belong. You've been adopted by my Father. Like, those, that's what people need to hear to undermine shame. So that's one way right there. There's some other ways, but I want to be sensitive to time and unpack things as would be helpful for you. But that's just this one example of the many effects of sexual abuse.
Well, I think it'd be incredibly helpful to keep walking through some of this, Justin. I know just the idea that there is future and hope, and restoration is such an important theme within our Christian faith. I know our final chapter of the biblical text talks about how the way will be opened again to the tree of life, and the leaves of those trees are for the healing of the nations. And so this idea of ongoing healing and restoration is really the heartbeat of the kingdom, and people can be healed and restored, right?
Absolutely. I love the way you put it. I wanted to go right to resurrection. I mean, what does resurrection mean for this? And you hit the nail on the head. Resurrection, Jesus coming back in the final resurrection and his resurrection are very helpful. So for his resurrection, and because he is the first fruits, we also will be raised. So his resurrection means that he wins. It means that the final word on the world and on us isn't brokenness and sin, because the cross is also a victory. It's upside down. We don't usually think victories are done by dying, but our God is different. And his kingdom is different from the kingdom of this world, where he conquers by death. And the picture in Revelation 5 is a lamb who was slain, but on the throne at the same exact time. His death is sacrificial, but his death is also conquering. So the resurrection tells us that sin, the sin done to us, is not the last chapter on our story. It's not the last word on us, but that our King and Savior has conquered our enemy, and that our enemy is not just our enemy, but God's enemy. And God is stronger than us and takes care of our enemy. And so he knows how to undo the wiles of evil. And so the way that evil destroys, and evil is like a virus that destroys. Well, we have the great physician who knows how to undo the virus, because sin is a parasite on God's good creation. It's not the way it's supposed to be, and he knows how to, as a good surgeon, knows how to cut that out, but also cut for the purpose of healing. And that's the painful part. The real painful part is actually not ignoring the suffering we've gone through because of sexual abuse, but actually going in trust to the character of God and saying, okay, I'm going to open up this wound, and I can't fix it. And I'm going to trust that you know what you're doing, and you can recreate where sin has uncreated your good creation and where it's harmed me as your image bearer. Not just, you know, we're his image bearers. He cares about all of his image bearers, but those who have faith in Christ are his children. And Jesus told us that he is a good father, and he knows how to give good gifts to his children who ask. And so all we're invited to do is really ask and trust, and then see what our good God does. And he's so creative and sovereign, who knows how he's going to enact healing and instill hope in your life. But it's because of the resurrection that we have hope to even go to him. Why would you go to the weak person who can't actually help you? You go to the strong one who loves you and say, wait, you're strong and you've conquered, but your disposition to me isn't conquering and dominating and all that. You do that with my enemy. To me, we get patience and gentleness and unconditional love because of the work of Jesus Christ.
That's Justin Holcomb, Episcopal priest and author, professor at Reformed Theological Seminary, Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, writes for Gospel Coalition, series of books out there. Justin, when we come back from break, I'm going to ask you just about, as we begin to engage with the great physician Jesus in this, it's not like we get spiritual amnesia about what might have happened in our past, but there is a healing that comes so it no longer has a power to shape and control us. So much more to come here with Justin Holcomb on Faith Radio Mornings. About 8 minutes before the top of the hour, and just thrilled to be joined on the line by Justin Holcomb as we're talking about how we can recover and experience some healing when some of these very difficult things of abuse happen, maybe in our lives or in the lives of people close to us. And Justin, I think one of the things that happens, you know, when abuse is so difficult is that we really wish it just would have never happened. When we think about our past and we think, gosh, the only way to healing is if I could almost just start over and this didn't happen. But we don't get that gift, right? When we work with God as a great physician, but there is a sense of healing that's still comes. And I often think about scars. Scars are there and they remind us of what happened, but they don't really affect our daily life anymore the way a weeping wound might. Is there some insight in some of that for healing and from abuse?
Yeah, and you said it really well on going out for the break. We don't get spiritual amnesia, and that's really helpful because many people, one of the main effects of sexual abuse is to deny or to minimize. And I don't mean like just, you know, some people do have a flood of memories come back because they just denied it completely and they just don't even know it really because for the abuse is so traumatic. But for most people, they just minimize it. And the answer to minimizing it, the good thing about minimizing, by the way, and kind of slowly denying it is that's a self-protection move. It's actually a good move at first. It kind of holds it at bay so you don't get just overwhelmed with the flood of reality of what happened. But long-term, keeping it at arm's length and denying it and minimizing it and, you know, finding a Bible verse and going, well, you know, God protects and we're fine, and just kind of theologically editing it away actually causes harm. So when we have the memory of the pain, one of the best things we can do is actually grieve, because that's what God's doing. God's response to our suffering is not annoyance. It's not, well, how'd you get yourself into that mess? He actually, his response in Scripture is grief and sorrow. So we're invited not to, you know, create our own sorrow. We invite people and we're invited by ourselves to participate in God's sorrow that he actually has for us. That's why 1 Thessalonians says we grieve, but we grieve like those who have hope because of the resurrection, going back to the resurrection again. So grief is not a reminding all the time and picking at the scars and the wounds. Grief is actually acknowledging what has happened, but also grieving with hope that something more will actually transform. And I wish what happened to me didn't happen to me, but at the same time, I can't imagine what I know and have experienced by God without that happening. So I don't call what happened to me good, but we learn from Genesis 50:20 the way that Joseph responded to being abused by his brothers, what those meant for evil, God bends and can use for good. That's going back to God's creative sovereignty. He's so creative, and thank God he's powerful and sovereign that he can turn evil and bend it into a tool that can actually be used for our deepening relationship with him and other people and healing.
Justin, I mean, that is part of that hopeful message. I mean, when you say those sorts of things about God bending it back towards good, I mean, that's the kind of thing C.S. Lewis would talk about in Narnia, that there's a deeper magic from before the dawn of time. There is something within his kingdom that we can hardly even understand, but that he brings these unbelievably difficult events, and yet he can ultimately redeem them for good. And that really is the hope that we can only find in the kingdom.
And that's because of that, that's why we're invited to cry out to God. Look at the Psalms. Many people think of Psalms as like, oh, they're worship songs. They are. They're the worship songs of the covenant community. But so many of them are lament and outcries. And the structure of a psalm is, God, you're mighty, but if you're so mighty, why is this happening? But because of the invitation to come to him for the deeper magic and that bending evil, that's why the Psalms turn back around to praise. Just even though I don't understand, I'll still worship you because you have been faithful. And here's the big thing. This is Philippians 1:6. God has been faithful. He's been faithful to Israel. He's been faithful to his people. Look backwards in history. He has been faithful. He's not going to stop being faithful with you. You as the individual. What God started, he will see through to completion. He's not thinking, well, I like being faithful except for you, Bob, except for you, Susan, because you're particularly messed up. And this, my faithfulness, I finally found someone in the world that can thwart my faithfulness. And the good news is that that's not how he thinks. It's the exact opposite. Right when we think we're not worthy, I'm looking at 1 Corinthians. I'm preaching this morning on 1 Corinthians, the very first 9 verses of 1 Corinthians 1. And God calls the Corinthians, who were pretty messed up, sanctified, saints, and blameless. I mean, because of the work of Jesus, our sins are forgiven and we are declared righteous, and no weapon formed against us will actually see it through to completion, because he has a better plan that he will see through to completion.
Justin, such helpful stuff this morning. Really appreciate you taking the time. I'd love to spend another hour with you. We got to run for the top of the hour, but thanks for just all of the really good words of wisdom and advice this morning.
Thank you, brother, and thank you for your ministry.
We'll take a break and wrap up our show here on Faith Radio Mornings. So appreciative of Justin Holcomb reminding us that that kingdom really has no end. There is always hope and always future in his beautiful kingdom. We'll catch you tomorrow morning, everybody, on Faith Radio Mornings.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.